Today's broadcast was originally recorded on September 10th, 2025.
The bottom line is that the bill they proposed can't get our votes, doesn't meet the needs of the American people, plain and simple.
Okay, so it won't get your vote, right? Right, Chuck Schumer?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Right?
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the airwaves and the internets around the country and the world. Blanketing planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Welcome to the Bradcast. With Congress now back in session in D.C. following their summer recess, the nation faces another one of those famous fiscal cliffs when the government will face a shutdown at the start of the new fiscal year, which begins on October 1, unless Democrats and Republicans can agree on a whole bunch of new spending bills. I think there are about 12 of them that Congress will eventually need to pass. But as that is not likely to happen before the end of this month, they'll have to agree to a so-called continuing resolution again to essentially continue the current spending limits already agreed to by Congress until a new full budget can be hashed out in order to avoid a government shutdown at the end of this month. But despite Republicans controlling the White House and both chambers of Congress, they will in fact need the support of at least some Democrats, 7 to be exact, in order to overcome the 60-vote threshold to overcome a filibuster in the U.S. Senate, which offers Democrats a very, very rare moment of political leverage in D.C. right now amid a government where they are otherwise having next to no power at the moment. But for right now, they actually do. What they plan to do with that leverage while risking the possibility of a government shutdown at the same time if they can't cut a deal with Republicans, that all remains to be seen. David Dayan of The American Prospect joins us shortly to discuss that fine mess. But we've got some, we got to begin with some disturbing news this afternoon, unfortunately, for which I will turn to AP here as this news is still breaking by the minute as we go to air. 31-year-old right-wing activist, influencer, and close ally of Donald Trump, Charlie Kirk, was shot earlier today while speaking at a Utah college event. He was rushed off stage and hospitalized in critical condition before later being pronounced dead just moments before airtime today in an act that is drawing renewed attention to the threat of political violence across the U.S. The suspected shooter has not been arrested, according to Orem, Utah Mayor David Young, after a person was earlier taken into custody by law enforcement at the university where Kirk was speaking. Turns out that person is not actually considered a suspect, that according to several different news outlets who have recently updated their reporting on that. Videos posted to social media from Utah Valley University show Kirk speaking into a handheld microphone while sitting under a white tent emblazoned with the slogans "The American Comeback" and "Prove Me Wrong." He was, perhaps ironically, being asked about the U.S. epidemic of mass shootings when a single shot rang out and Kirk can be seen grasping the left side of his neck with his right hand. Spectators are heard gasping and screaming, and people start to run away. Before the news of his death came, again, just moments before air today, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle were already reacting to reports of the shooting, with many Republicans issuing calls for prayers and Democrats decrying the political violence. Among notable Democrats, California Governor Gavin Newsom weighed in on social media, writing, quote, "The attack on Charlie Kirk is disgusting, vile, and reprehensible. In the United States of America," he said, "we must reject political violence in every form." Kirk was speaking at a debate hosted by his nonprofit political organization, Turning Point USA, which was instrumental in turning out the youth vote for Donald Trump in last year's election. Moments before the single shot rang out, an audience member asked Kirk, quote, "Do you know how many transgender Americans have been mass shooters over the last 10 years? Kirk responded, "Too many." The questioner followed up, "Do you know how many mass shooters have been in America over the last 10 years? Kirk asked, "Counting or not counting gang violence?" Then a shot rang out. The event has been met with the speaking event by Kirk had been met with divided opinions on the campus. There was a petition with nearly 1,000 signatures calling for university administrators to bar Kirk from appearing. But the university issued a statement last week citing First Amendment rights and affirming its, quote, "commitment to free speech, intellectual inquiry, and constructive dialogue." The shooting comes amid a spike in political violence in the U.S. The attacks include of late include the assassinations of a Democratic Minnesota state lawmaker and her husband at their house in June, along with the shooting of another state Democratic lawmaker by the same shooter that very same night as well, along with a firebomb set off at the house of Pennsylvania's Democratic governor, who is Jewish, back in April of this year. Turning Point USA was founded in suburban Chicago back in 2012 by Kirk, who was then 18, and by William Montgomery, a Tea Party activist. They proselytized on college campuses for lower taxes and limited government. The group was not an immediate success, reports AP, but Kirk's zeal for confronting liberals in academia eventually won over an influential set of right-wing financiers. Turning Point enthusiastically backed Trump after he clinched the GOP nomination back in 2016. Kirk served as a personal aide to Donald Trump Jr. during the general election campaign that year. Kirk was then soon a regular presence on cable TV, where he leaned into the culture wars and heaped praise on the then president, Donald Trump, and his son. Both appeared at Turning Point conferences. Charlie Kirk dead today at 31. No suspect is yet in custody as we go to air this afternoon. That shooting, sadly, was not the only one of note today, and a story that might have received more attention, but for the shooting of Kirk in Utah, three teens were hospitalized in critical condition after a shooting at a suburban Denver high school on Wednesday. The shooting happened around midday at Evergreen High School in Evergreen, Colorado, about 30 miles west of Denver, according to a Jefferson County Sheriff's Office spokesperson. All of those taken to the hospital were believed to be students, though there were no immediate additional details on their injuries. All three teens were either in the emergency room or undergoing surgery as of mid-afternoon at a hospital in Lakewood, Colorado. It's not clear who the shooter was or how many shooters might have been involved. Over 100 police officers from around Denver rushed to the school to try to help, according to the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office, which was, perhaps ironically, certainly disturbingly, the very same agency that initially responded to the 1999 Columbine High School shooting that killed 14 people, including, by the way, a woman who died earlier this year of complications from her injuries in that shooting 26 years ago. And while we are shuffling around things around today, obviously, given the late news this afternoon about Charlie Kirk, I do want to at least briefly hit one more important item here before my conversation with David, as it is also a newly developing story worth keeping your eyes on, it seems to me, today. Poland said a number of Russian drones entered its airspace during an attack on Ukraine early Wednesday, and they were shot down with the help of NATO allies, which is a first since Moscow's full-scale invasion of its sovereign neighbor. Leaders across Europe condemned the incident as the latest sign of escalation from the Kremlin, which has rebuffed Donald Trump's bid to broker peace talks, even though Donald Trump said that he would solve that. What was it, Desi Doyen, within 24 hours.
Repeatedly, he said that.
24 hours, by the way, of being elected for a second term of office, not just 24 hours after being sworn in as president. So far, he has failed on that front. And this confrontation in Europe could be about to get a lot worse. We will hope that it won't. The Russian Defense Ministry said it had attacked the, quote, military-industrial complex of Ukraine in a large-scale attack, unquote, but that, quote, there were no targets envisioned for destruction on the Polish territory. But the Polish foreign minister, Radoslaw Sikorski, said that there was no doubt that the incursion was intentional, calling the violation an unprecedented attack on NATO and the European Union. In this case, he said, there were 19 breaches, and it simply defies imagination that it could be accidental, he told reporters. 19 drones, in other words, breaching the border and entering Poland. Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk, yes, that's the name of the Polish Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, said earlier that his country had dealt with, quote, a large-scale provocation, and that four of the 19 recorded drones were shot down. Tusk added that a significant number of the drones flew in from Belarus, an authoritarian ally of Russia, used as a launching pad for the initial attacks on Ukraine and still for additional attacks on Ukraine, apparently. Tusk told the Polish parliament, quote, I have no reason to claim that we're on the brink of war, but, he said, a line has been crossed. This situation brings us the closest we have been to open conflict since World War II. That's somewhat chilling. Thankfully, we've got a steady hand here in the White House, so why worry? Belarus said the drones in this case had, quote, lost their way, okay, and that it had also shot some of those drones down over its own territory. The Polish military's operational command called the drones an act of aggression. It later thanked NATO Air Command and the Dutch Air Force, who scrambled F-35 fighter jets in response. Poland and the U.S. are both members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, a mutual defense pact formed after World War II to deal with the threat then posed by the Soviet Union, meaning an attack on one may be considered an attack on all. The Polish Prime Minister Tusk said that he had activated Article 4 of NATO's treaty, under which alliance members can demand consultations with their allies, and that he was in touch with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, who called the incursion, quote, reckless behavior, irrespective of whether it was deliberate or not. A NATO official confirmed to NBC News that Poland had requested consultations under Article 4 of the Washington Treaty, only the eighth time that that article, which does not trigger a military reaction, has been invoked since NATO was established in 1949. Increasing evidence, including the direction of travel, indicated this quote was no accident that, according to the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, in a social media posting in response, the European Union called it the most serious European airspace violation by Russia since it invaded Ukraine in 2022. Since Russia invaded Ukraine, neighboring Poland has remained on high alert, especially after a stray Ukrainian missile struck a Polish village a few months into the war back in 2022 and killed two people there. Russian missiles have also briefly entered Polish airspace on at least two occasions, but this is something else. This is something new. 19 drones entering Poland. This new incident showed Russian President Vladimir Putin was, quote, clearly testing NATO, according to a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, a think tank in D.C., who told NBC, quote, he wants to see how far he can push and whether he can push further. It is also payback, he said, for Poland's very central role in the war on Ukraine as the prime logistical hub for U.S. and NATO and Western allied weapons. Poland is, quote, now a part of this war, he said. They are much more on the front line than they were 24 hours ago. So, yeah, not a great day all around.
No.
But turning back to D.C. for the moment, some slightly brighter news and another U.S. House special election victory for Democrats on Tuesday night. Democratic Fairfax County, Virginia Supervisor James Walkinshaw defeated Republican Stuart Whitson easily on Tuesday, with the Associated Press calling the race for an open seat in the 11th Congressional District of Virginia shortly after the polls closed. And when Politico describes that victory of Walkinshaw over Whitson as an easy defeat, well, they weren't kidding. The Democratic candidate, Walkinshaw, as of late last night, picked up almost 75% of the vote over the Republican, who won just 25% of the vote. That's a 50-point victory for the Democrats, where in a district where Kamala Harris defeated Donald Trump by just 34 points last year. So again, another overperformance by the Democrats, this time by about 16 points as compared to last November. The race for the seat in Virginia's 11th congressional district was to fill the seat left vacant by the late Democratic Congressman Jerry Connolly, who died in May. Earlier this week, I told you that the so-called discharge petition in the U.S. House to try and force a vote on releasing the complete Epstein files currently has 212 signatures from Democratic lawmakers. That's all of the currently seated Democrats, and from four Republican members, for a total of 216. Now, it needs just 218, which is a majority in the U.S. House, in order to force the vote to release those files that Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson is otherwise refusing to hold. Walkinshaw, the Democrat out of Virginia, has said that he will sign that petition once he is seated in Congress. So that would bring the number up to 217. And there is another special U.S. House election in Arizona later this month on the 23rd, where Adelita Grijalva, the daughter of the late Democratic Congressman Raul Grijalva, is expected to win that seat vacated by her father with his death earlier this year. She, too, has vowed to sign that bipartisan discharge petition, which would give lawmakers calling for the release of the Epstein files the 218 signatures needed for a vote and presumably enough votes to win in the a resolution in the U.S. House after she is seated, if she is victorious later this month, as expected. Walkinshaw's victory for Democrats in the northern Virginia suburbs of Washington, meanwhile, on Tuesday, is also significant, given that it decreases Republicans' already tiny majority in the U.S. House, even as the government faces a potential shutdown at the end of this month, unless Republicans can somehow make a deal with Democrats. Let's take a quick break, and we will turn our attention back to that matter as a critical standoff begins to take shape in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. We will discuss the stakes and the possibilities with financial journalist and American Prospect executive editor David Dayan, who I spoke with earlier today about exactly that. My conversation with him is straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What's What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast. Welcome back to The Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. As Congress returned to work last week following their August recess and a full month of Trump's unbridled, ever-increasing authoritarianism, political scientist Jonathan Bernstein wrote in his Good Politics, Bad Politics newsletter in an item headlined Where We Are After 7 Months of Trump, quote, I'll try to keep this simple, he said. One, Trump is acting as a dictator. Two, he is fairly easily defeated time after time when people fight back. Three, far too few people are fighting back. And he goes on to say, I think that's pretty much what I have. Well, as it turns out, he had more as he elaborated on those points, but his main point was clear. Now is the time to fight back against Trump's excesses as he is, quote, repeatedly just ignoring the law, the Constitution, democratic norms, and any other built-in constraints on his presidency, says Bernstein. But that, quote, Trump remains terrible at the actual job of presidenting, which, yes, argues Bernstein, makes him easy to defeat when people bother to fight back. He basically has one move, writes Bernstein, bully his way around, bull in a China shop style. It works if no one fights back. It doesn't work the rest of the time, proving that, quote, those who have fought Trump's autocratic power grabs stand a good chance to win, but too many, he says, have just surrendered. Bernstein's piece was cited by our friend David Dayan over at the American Prospect in what normally would have been David's back-to-school column detailing the pressing policy issues awaiting Congress after its summer break. But he writes, quote, at this point, I think it would be a fruitless endeavor to operate as if the U.S. Congress is a primary or even peripheral engine for making policy in this country. Federal troops are in one American city, albeit engaged in sanitation duty, he notes, and will soon be in others. Federal agencies are being dismantled at the whim of the powerful. Federal paramilitaries continue to kidnap people off the street, often people here legally, and disappear them into the carceral state. People who have criticized the president are being targeted for arrest or harassment or worse. A compliant Supreme Court blesses illegal administration activities on a routine basis. The firing of a railroad regulator for the offense of being a Democrat in the midst of a review of the largest consolidation of freight rail in U.S. history is a mere footnote amid the chaos, writes Dayan, which is true because, frankly, I hadn't even heard of that last one. Dayan argues that, quote, usually a despot grows unpopular after years in power, but in this case, Trump is already unpopular amid his ascent to power. His latest approval numbers are at 37%, a low for this term, and even the good numbers show him to be, yes, unpopular. How can such an unlikable figure be so intimidating, he wonders. How can the Wizard of Oz inspire obedience after the curtain has been pulled back, revealing his diminutive stature? But, citing Bernstein, who argues that those with the ability to stop Trump are sleepwalking, Dayan observes the key element that has made Trump's second term different from the first is that the pushback at the national level from the opposition party is at best pathetic, at worst non-existent. Governors, however, have found their voice, but the leadership in Washington, he says, is foundering, even as they are made irrelevant. All of that is true. Even as Democratic leadership in Washington, in Congress, have an opportunity, a duty, I would argue, to become not irrelevant before the end of this month, when the stopgap spending bill called a continuing resolution, or CR, adopted last March by Congress with the support of a handful of Democrats in the Senate, will expire. In March, the move to help Republicans was led by Chuck Schumer, who voted for the CR to prevent the government from shutting down, even after Republicans refused to negotiate with Democrats at all on anything. For the record, Democrats in the House back in March all voted against the measure in the lower chamber, but lost to the Republicans' slim majority there, leaving it to Senate Democrats to block the measure. And yes, force a shutdown in the bargain unless enough of them joined Republicans to help them have the 60 votes needed to overcome a filibuster and prevent a shutdown, which Schumer feared would hurt Americans and his party. If anything, writes Dayan this week, the lawless actions and usurped spending powers by the Trump administration in the intervening 6 months since the CR was adopted back in March with Democrats' help have grown worse. One rescission package to reverse already approved appropriations has passed. Another so-called pocket rescission, where the administration is trying to cut approved spending without even giving Congress a say in the matter, has been issued. So-called pocket rescissions, by the way, are illegal, but maybe we'll get to that in a moment. Hundreds of billions of dollars in grants that are required by law to be sent have been withheld, and the White House is putting troops in American cities using paramilitary immigration forces to kidnap people off the streets and engaging in untold other abuses, observes Dayan. Once again, he says, Democrats can decide whether to participate in this destruction of the nation's founding principles or resist it. It's a rare point of leverage in a time when national policy is being run almost exclusively out of the Oval Office. Dayan adds, quote, I've been skeptical that Democrats have any real strategy for what to do, but a strategy, he says, is actually emerging. Now, David's use of the word strategy there may be doing a lot of work, but yes, Democrats do seem to have some idea of what they may demand or ask for in exchange for their votes to not shut down the government as of October 1. And it has to do with health care and extending the expanded premium support for some 30 million Americans signed up to health care plans via the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, which otherwise will expire at the end of this year. But is this ask nearly enough? And should Democrats even be offering this fig leaf at all in the first place? Shouldn't they be asking for much more? And by the way, what happens if Republicans refuse whatever Democratic demands may come in exchange for their support? Is Chuck Schumer ready this time to stand by a government shutdown if Republicans say no? Republicans do not seem to mind when governments shut down, after all. Joining us now for insight on all of this is our old friend David Dayan, financial journalist, executive editor at the American Prospect, and author of several excellent books, including his latest, Monopolized: Life in the Age of Corporate Power. Oh, Mr. Dayan, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
And as always, thank you for having me.
So, Dave, before we get into the specifics of what you describe as the emerging strategy here from Democrats to take advantage of this rare moment of leverage that they now have in Congress, I see a lot of disenchanted Democrats complaining that their party leaders in Congress are simply not fighting back hard enough. Sleepwalking, as I think you described it, against the Trump and the Republicans. But it's unclear what they actually should be doing, at least to me. I know that, you know, in the states, folks like Gavin Newsom in California, J.B. Pritzker in Illinois, that they actually have executive power that they can leverage to push back against Trump. But other than these rare moments when Republicans need Democratic votes to, for example, keep the government open, I'm not sure. And I'm genuinely asking this, what is it that folks would like to see Democrats doing more of? Do you understand what they're asking for?
I mean, it's certainly true that people can have unrealistic expectations of how to get out of this mess. And they could be wish casting that someone can make it all go away. So I'll grant at least some of that. But 6 months ago, as you mentioned in the open, we were in the same position. Mm-hmm. Democrats had the ability to block funding for, you know, and make whatever ask they wanted because their votes were needed, and they chose not to. And in that time when Chuck Schumer said, I'm not going to do it, he said, let's see what happens with the Supreme Court. Let's see what Trump does. Let's see where we're at down the road. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we've seen where we're at.
Right.
And Democrats have had 6 months to figure out their own strategy. It's really not my job to figure it out for them. This is why literally they are elected into office, mm-hmm. To represent their constituents. And their constituents are obviously very unhappy with the representation that they've been getting. And so do I have ideas for what they can do? I think I do. I mean, I think the biggest thing is, you know, we're talking about a budget deal where mm-hmm. Democrats and Republicans shake hands and say, this is the amount of money we're spending in the federal government. And what Donald Trump has done by his actions is say, that piece of paper is worthless. I'm going to fund whatever I want, and I can withhold funding if that suits me. I can rescind funding if that suits me. I can do that with just Republicans to pass it, or I don't even need Republicans if I do a pocket rescission, and I can just get rid of this funding. There is no way you can hold a negotiation between these two parties if one party is saying, I can rip up the agreement whenever I want to.
Right.
So one of the ways that you could actually operationalize to the agreement is you could, for example, eliminate the ability to do rescissions for this particular budget. You could say that the part of the Impoundment Control Act of 1974 does not apply to this budget agreement, therefore strengthening the idea that you have to do the spending that is held here. And there are probably other safeguards that can be included there. So, you know, if the problem is, I don't want to do a budget agreement because I don't think the other side is going to hold to it, you have to do something to ensure that they hold to it. And I think, you know, you have to come up with your ideas from there.
And not only is there nothing that would keep Democrats from insisting on something like that being in there. And by the way, that would seem to be good for Republicans, too, because it's Republican spending, that has been approved by Republicans in Congress that is being withheld when he.
In some cases, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even Republican appropriators have said it's illegal to do pocket rescissions. That Republicans have written to Trump to say, there are these amounts of things that we want spending on. There was an incident a few weeks ago where they asked for spending to be restored for public education. And it was after a few days. But it took Republicans to do that. So, you know, I think unless Congress wants to dissolve as a part of the government, I think they would be all too happy to see their spending choices actually put forward and put in a place where they would actually happen by through an agreement with the executive would sign.
So at a minimum, I mean, that's a provision like that seems like something that Republicans, in theory, might want to have in such an agreement, but it's pretty small ball overall. The emerging strategy from the Democratic leadership right now appears to be extending the expanded premium support for the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. That seems important, obvious that should be expanded because it runs out at the end of the year. But, can you explain the stakes here and what it is that Dems appear to be planning to propose as at least part of their proposal, if not the entire proposal, which concerns me, but we'll get to that.
It's definitely important. Starting with the American Rescue Plan and continuing in the Inflation Reduction Act, Democrats have passed these enhanced subsidies to correct a real fundamental flaw in the Affordable Care Act, which was that once you hit a certain level of income, there was a cliff effect where you were no longer eligible for subsidies. And because of that, people who made $1 over the limit were paying massive amounts for health insurance in the insurance exchanges relative to people who made just a little bit less.
Right.
And so these subsidies were put in to ensure that nobody was paying over a certain percentage of their income for health insurance if they were on the insurance exchanges. And if they go away, and as you correctly say, they expire at the end of the year, if they go away, the average increase for somebody affected by this is going to be something like 75%. So that's a massive amount of money. And CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, estimates that between 4 and 5 million people would lose their health care as a result, lose their health insurance. And those who wouldn't would just be paying just a massive amount of money and foregoing all kinds of other things to afford their health insurance.
It's a massive.
So is it important? Yes. Is it a really bad thing to do? Yes. So much so that Republicans, before this was even a conversation in the context of the budget, were debating whether or not to extend these subsidies. In fact, there's a bill right now in Congress from several Republican members, frontline members, where, you know, enough to pass it in the House that it, presuming every Democrat would vote for this, and they would, that would extend the subsidy. And so you have a situation where Republicans know that they would get killed for this in the midterm elections if they allow this massive increase in the cost of health insurance during an affordability crisis. This, you know, they actually need, whether or not they want to pass it, they actually need to pass something like this to prevent an apocalyptic scenario for them.
Because this is is not only a massive amount of money, you said, that it's going to cost Americans. It's actually a massive amount of Americans. It's tens of millions of Americans, Republicans, Democrats, independents, who are all relying on this these enhanced subsidies, this expanded support, which we should note, you called it the American Rescue Plan. That was the plan that was put in place when after Joe Biden took office, if I'm not mistaken, completely Democratic votes entirely to pass it. I think
in both of those, know, it was a 2-year extension in the American Rescue Plan to 2023. Only Democrats voted for that. Another 2-year extension into 2025 that was in the Inflation Reduction Act. Also, only Democrats voted for that. So Democrats are the ones who have pushed this forward for the last 4 years. And Republicans are scared that, that they're going to have to bear the consequences of not passing this. And so why would you put this into the context of a budget negotiation, particularly if you only extend it through the midterms, literally to relieve them of the consequences?
That's what the Republican, the so-called bipartisan bill for this that the Republicans put forward, that's what that does. Only a year, right?
It's only a year. And so, you know, it seems like if you were to make the proposition, and I think some Democrats are saying this, that extend these subsidies for a year and in exchange will participate in your budget resolution. And that seems to me to be trading something Republicans need for something Republicans want. And the question is, what do Democrats get out of that exchange?
Well, of course, other than, you know, helping a whole bunch of Americans be able to afford health care, but only for a short time. I mean, it's sort of like Democrats who are saying, hey, let us help you. Let us save you from yourself by passing this. On the other hand, David Dayan, if this was if the proposal here was, OK, great. Glad you want to extend it for a year. How about let's make those enhanced subsidies permanent? Would that be something durable that the Democrats might say, okay, this is worth giving them our votes to keep the government open?
I just think Republicans are so desperate on this that I don't understand why it has to be done in the context of a budget negotiation. Mm. You know, if they want to pass this and there can be a negotiation between whether or not it's permanent and whether or not it's paid for, et cetera, why not just have that debate? Mm. Why is it tied to something where the real problem with a budget deal is the fact that Donald Trump won't abide by the budget deal? Right. You know, the whole idea that we're going to get a goodie in exchange for participation in the budget is a very old way of doing business in Washington, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
You know, you have something you want, I have something I want, and we'll make a trade. Business as usual is out the window right. in Washington. You have someone who is trying to consolidate power entirely into himself, and you have these rare moments where he can be thwarted at some level. And you can't approach that the way you would approach a normal negotiation. I just don't understand how that could be acceptable. You have to deal with the problem at hand, which is Donald Trump is acting like a despot, like a dictator. And the things that you could negotiate on would have to be things that prevent that dictatorial, processes from going forward.
As you note, those subsidies and the ACA, those run out anyway at the end of September. At the end of the year. So if the fiscal cliff, as we like to call it, at the beginning of October, when the government could shut down, that's its own thing. No matter what happens there, there's another fiscal cliff beyond that at the end of the year when these subsidies run out. And so,
right.
yeah, let the Republicans deal with that, it seems to me. But in order to keep the government open, what sort of things would you like to see, David Dayen, if you were actually, before you answer that question, are you suggesting that Schumer is basically behaving here like we're not in a, you know, an authoritarian crisis, that he's basically behaving like the old school Democrats? You give me this, we'll give you that, etc. Is that what?
Yeah,
what
I don't see any level of urgency about what we have seen transpire in the last several months. I don't know if that's your opinion of the matter, but that's how I see it. Democrats are acting like, hey, it's time to cut a deal, and I just don't think that is the appropriate response to someone who has really negated Congress as a full and equal partner in the government at this point.
But
so
what I'm surprised by is the fact that we're even having this discussion. I mean, there's been 6 months since Schumer, and I noticed Schumer ticked off a lot of Democrats by agreeing to go along with him in March with the Republicans. But I think there was an argument to be made at that time. He might have been right. He might have been wrong. I don't think it was a terrible idea, even though I know some Democrats were upset to see Democrats going along, you know, with Republicans and Trump in any way. But there was an argument to be made back then. But 6 months later, after all of the things that I described in the opening, reading from your piece, all the things that he has done since then that we know, the idea that Democrats don't already have a proposal in place to say this is what we are demanding or you can all go to hell as of October 1, the fact that they're sort of pulling their ideas together now, it seems to me, that's what kind of seems to surprise me the most.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that Democrats seem sort of perpetually unprepared for the urgent needs of the people and the urgent needs of political strategy is a big shock.
So what kind of things would you like to see throw, you know, if setting aside the ACA, what could they put into a proposal?
As I said, I think you have to deal with the matters at hand. So, you know, what are the steps Trump is taking to act in a dictatorial manner, and what are the steps that Democrats are prepared to do to prevent, slow, or mitigate that in some way? Mm-hmm. So one, as I said, was you can exempt the budget from any rescission provisions, eliminating the ability for the president to take spending that is in the budget and eliminate. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. You could say that no money from this budget can go toward the deployment of National Guard troops in any state on U.S. soil. Mm-hmm. You could say that the emergency powers that are passed in the Emergency Powers Act cannot permit the issuance of tariffs. Mm-hmm. So you have to look to the things where Trump has usurped power from the other branches of government, and then operate the way, not just that an opposition party should, but the way that a co-equal branch of government should, to wrest that power back and bring things into balance. Maybe it's eliminating the presidential budget in some manner. Mm. I think that we are thinking along way too strange issue-based lines when you're talking about this, and not talking about trying to preserve what's left of the government.
The ACA, you know, expanding that seems to be a no-brainer, but it seems to be low-hanging fruit. The things you mentioned, ending rescission, basically, you know, stop the authoritarianism, I think, as Josh right. Marshall describes it. Put those things in there. And by the way, you know, healthcare is important. Millions of people are about to lose their healthcare from the cuts to Medicaid and potentially Medicare that just happened because of the so-called big, beautiful bill. Those things, you know, at the very least, seems like they ought to be put into a package, a proposal, at least an initial proposal to the Republicans, as long as you're asking for stuff at this point. No.
Yes, at some level, I feel like, you know, talking about discrete issues mm. isn't necessarily the way to go mm. here. Mm. I really think it's about, you know, we want to stop this president from acting like a dictator. I think that's the firm ground that you have here, because and the other way to talk about this, by the way, is to say that, okay, Donald Trump thinks that Congress is kind of an unnecessary hurdle in his path, then you go ahead and figure out how to pass the budget, Republicans. Mm-hmm. You go ahead and do that on your own. And, you know, if you want to come to us with a solution, you can. So I think that if Democrats lay out a broad set of principles, which is we don't think there should be dictators or kings in America, mm. and say we're not going to be satisfied by any budget agreement that doesn't put in safeguards so that those kings or dictators are dissolved, essentially, then we're not going to participate. And I think you get further than saying, okay, you can be a dictator, but as long as you pass incremental subsidies right. for, you know, a certain number of Americans. I just think that you have to stand on principle here rather than trying to get some goodies.
Especially incremental subsidies that, as Josh was arguing, that nobody will even ever know that they got. Democrats, Chuck Schumer, will be able to say, hey, we saved the Affordable Care Act for another 6 months or a year, but nobody will really know that. They will know it, however, if the government shuts down on the demand that Donald Trump stop the authoritarianism there. But there is a cost, David. If Republicans simply refuse to meet the demands of Democrats, whatever they are, small ball or large ball here, if they just say, no, we ain't going to do that, well, then we got a government shutdown, which will also affect millions of people. Who would pay the political price for that? Democrats or Republicans or Trump? Isn't that a cost that needs to be considered here as well?
I mean, obviously, we don't have that information in advance. But what I can tell you is, you know, government shutdowns are a fairly new phenomenon. It comes out of something in the 1970s where Jimmy Carter's attorney general made this opinion that that if the government shut down, then workers would have to be furloughed and that certain processes would have to stop. Prior to that, that didn't happen. So we only have about 40, 45 years of history here. And from my vantage point, every time the government has shut down, Republicans have been the ones who have lost the subsequent battle and ultimate outcome. Mm. If you're talking about the 1990s, government shut down under Bill Clinton, and Newt Gingrich paid the price in terms of who paid the political impact, and nothing really that they wanted out of that got ended up happening. Mm-hmm. Ted Cruz shut down the government to try to repeal Obamacare. Obviously, Obamacare was not repealed. Mm-hmm. In Trump's first term, the government shut down a couple times, mm-hmm. and Trump was the one looking for changes to the budget, and he ended up budget that had none of his changes in it. So whether the White House is controlled by Democrats or Republicans, whether the Congress is controlled by Democrats or Republicans, seems like Democrats win these fights. Mm. And I'm just looking at the empirical evidence of that.
Right.
And I would argue that the reason is that there is this sort of residual understanding among the public that Democrats don't want to shut the government down, that they are more responsible, that they're not given to hostage taking, and that Republicans generally are. And, you know, ultimately, I think there are ways to position this as the government is shutting down because Trump won't abide by any decision that is made and any negotiation that is made and any compromise budget that is made. Mm-hmm. And if you frame it that way, I think it would be very hard for Donald Trump to win that fight and get a budget on his terms. So that, I think, is the way to go about that.
It's somewhat remarkable that we're talking about this just weeks before the government would shut down, that Democrats aren't already showing up after August with a strategy along these lines. There are, by the way, concerns that I guess we need to speak. We heard a lot about this during the same debate back in March from Schumer about how Trump could run roughshod over the bureaucracy if the funding is cut off during a government shutdown, which sort of gives the president certain emergency powers during the shutdown, that he would abuse those powers and use them to trash the federal government. Your response to those concerns here in September of 2025, David?
Well, I mean, it's just, I kind of don't even know what to say about stuff like this. You know, the Democratic Party is structurally an inadequate opposition to what we are seeing right now in the United States. I think that's sort of the best way that I can describe this, the best way that I can put it. I'm going to give you a quote that was actually in my story. It doesn't come from me, but it comes from Punchbowl. Mm-hmm. And Senator Mark Kelly shows an understanding of the stakes of where we're at right now, and then says this. He says, "We are in uncharted territory, but I still believe it is in the best interest of our country to do as much as we can in a bipartisan way." And I think that the second sentence is just completely negated by the first sentence. You know, we're in uncharted territory. The right. idea, the rules of politics, that bipartisan solutions are durable and sustainable, et cetera, just don't, they don't amount to anything anymore. Mm-hmm. And I don't see on the part of Democrats, maybe they understand what's happening, but they're not willing to do what it takes to try to change the direction in a meaningful way. And that's what this opportunity gives. You know, I mean, a lot of the things that we're talking about, you would only know if you listen to Brad Friedman or if you read The Prospect. Mm. And not everybody in the country does that, I'm sorry to say.
What?
Yes. So shutdown fights like this are teachable moments.
Right.
There are ways to get the attention of the public.
Right.
There are ways to get the public understanding that there's a debate happening in Washington, and this is what that debate is about. And if you're the Democratic Party staring down 33% approval ratings, watching what Trump is doing and seeing only your party get less popular in the exchange because you're not doing enough about it, you should want this moment. Mm-hmm. You should want a way to reset the public attention on what is happening. And, I just, maybe we'll see some things start to change here in the coming days as Democrats internalize this. But, it's been a bit enervating so far.
Yeah, but you make an excellent point that in one sense, no matter what successes they might get out of some sort of a deal by October 1, the biggest advantage they may get is attention on what is going on in a world right now where nobody has time to pay attention to anything because there's so much going on. You're right. All of the people who don't read The American Prospect or listen to the broadcast would suddenly figure out, oh, there is something going on in Washington. And, oh, look, it's Democrats trying to fight against authoritarianism. They might like that. Maybe we got to figure out how to get that message to those Democrats.
Totally agree.
David Dayan, executive editor of The American Prospect, a 2021 Sidney Hillman Prize winner for magazine journalism and the author of Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power. He's also hosts a podcast with Matt Stoller called Organized Money. David, always a delight speaking with you, sir. We will be doing it again before we all fall off the next fiscal cliff.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. All righty, then. Let's get out,
yes,
shall we?
Yes, let's do.
My thanks again to David Dayan and to our producer, Desi Doyen.
Yes.
And to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com, where we have no paywall because we rely only on you, yes, listeners like you, to stay on your public airwaves. So when you go to bradblog.com, please do hit one of those donate buttons or just go straight to bradblog.com/donate, where we make it really easy for you to help support our continuing work. That's bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, particularly Blue Sky, you will find me at The Brad Blog. Please follow and share. All right, that's it. We'll see you at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.